Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for listening to What Mama Wants. Personally, I think Mother Earth wants less toxics and more health for her planet. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxic poisons like mercury, PFAS, pesticides are having in our daily lives. My guest today is Ruth Hennig. For about 30 years, Ruth was the executive director of the John Merck Charitable Foundation, which supported research for improved human health. She now lives in Maine and is a state advisor on the Conservation Law Foundation and serves on the board of Defend Our Health. Ruth, thank you for joining me on What Mama Wants today.
It's a pleasure, Kate.
Your work as the executive director of the John Merck Fund was actually to fund research on toxics in part. You oversaw programs on health and the environment and developmental disabilities. Those things led to breakthroughs in prevention and treatment. So I wondered if you could tell us some insights you gained about doing that kind of work.
Well, first, thanks again for having me. It's really a pleasure. The couple of insights since the John Merck Fund was working simultaneously on both climate change and clean energy, as well as environmental health. And what does that mean exactly? It means the impact to our health from exposures in the environment. And so we were doing both kinds of grant making to a whole range of organizations, some research, as you mentioned, but also a lot of advocacy and public education and grassroots organizing. So running the gamut of nonprofit activity on both those topics.
And which happens to be a kind of ridiculously cool job now.
It was kind of cool.
Yeah, and so you get to give millions of dollars away to people who are fighting against letting toxics rule the world.
Yeah, it was tremendously rewarding and stimulating, and I didn't have to go raise money. So
two big wins.
Right. But in the process of experiencing those two different issue areas, as long as I did, it was always striking that climate change had more money, had more public and media awareness, and a greater sense of urgency to it than the relatively smaller set of activities that were going on under the toxics and environmental health rubric. And why is that? I mean, they're both urgent issues, but the best way I came up with understanding the reason for the big disparity between climate change and the much less well-known environmental health or toxics is that climate change is just easier to understand in a lot of ways. It's more clear-cut. There are just a handful of chemicals that are perturbing and warming our climate, believe it or not, even though it's having a planetary-wide as well as localized impacts. The number of chemicals is relatively small, whereas over on toxics, we're talking about 80,000 chemicals spread across, you know, vast numbers of people, large populations. And so just figuring out what the relationship is between those 80,000 toxic chemicals in commerce and what is the health impact to you or to me, that's a hard thing to do. So climate is just easier to grasp in some ways. And the other big difference is that although a cancer diagnosis or having autism can be devastating to me as an individual or to my family, the impacts from climate change just visually are so much more dramatic. And we're all seeing and experiencing the flooding, the droughts, the wildfires, and you have a sort of an apocalyptic sense about climate change impacts. So you get this reinforcing feedback loop, I think, between climate being portrayed as, you know, it's the existential threat of our time. And literally people in the scientific and policymaking communities say that. The media has absorbed that message and they play that message back, which just reinforces it. And so you get that sense of much greater urgency in climate change because it's in part being driven by the money.
So are you saying that they're kind of competing interests, even though they're interrelated.
They are interrelated. And that's something that we're just starting to really appreciate and to think about as we think about solutions to these problems. And the relationship is super simple. It's because fossil fuels are the feedstock for both our energy production, whether it be gas, oil, or coal. Fossil fuels are also the feedstock for all the chemicals that we're putting into the environment as we develop, you know, a million plastic products. And so if you are wanting to really take the biggest possible picture in looking for solutions to these two issues, they actually are interrelated. And we've underappreciated that connection until recently. And I think that's where we are going forward, going to get the biggest bang for our buck in
You're
terms
saying,
of finding solutions.
Right. Go after Darth Plastic.
Darth Plastic. Yeah.
And the point you make about kind of the sexiness of the competing interests of the global climate change versus global destruction through toxic chemicals, one shows up on TV a lot better.
Yes.
It's really difficult to show the antimony and the cobalt leaching into your Coca-Cola through the plastic bottle, but it's much easier to show a forest fire and sexier.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So both are really serious, and they're both connected maybe through plastics.
Yeah.
Hmm. Thanks.
You're exactly right.
Why don't we fund more toxics research and advocacy? Is it for the same reason? Funders want to go after the most important thing with their dollars?
That's right. I mean, there's been good communication, very well funded over many years now. I mean, the climate change issue as a public thing to pay attention to emerged in the late 1980s. So we've had about 40 years of, you know, grappling with this problem. Individual donors have had that time to absorb the message about climate change as, you know, the yeah. existential threat of our time. Now, interestingly, Rachel Carson put toxics on the map for us all about 15 years earlier
yeah.
with Silent Spring. But for the reasons that I've been trying to describe, the traction that climate change has gotten in the media, in policy making, and in government decision making about where resource dollars go has tended to skew there.
Mm-hmm. You had said earlier, it's something like 10 to 1.
It's
dollars
actually,
going to climate.
I didn't have a chance to look, but I'm going to take a leap here and say you're undercounted by about 10 times.
Oh,
I think
really?
It's more like 100 to 1.
So many more climate dollars than toxic dollars.
That's right. Even though, of course, they're both big problems, there's no point in making one compete against the other, whether
it's interesting
we're disturbing our ecosystem or our genes in the human species, and what does that do to our health? Both are critical to our survival as species in this ecosystem we call planet Earth. But again, it's just like with so many things, where does the attention go and where do the dollars go?
Yeah, so we vote more dollars for toxics research and advocacy.
Yes.
Quite aside from your professional life, you have had two dances with breast cancer. I wonder what your experiences were like with the cancer. You know, you probably knew too much.
I did know too much, but that's at a theoretical level. When you get the phone call from your doctor saying you have cancer, it puts it on a whole different personal level, and all the theoretical stuff kind of goes out the window for a while, because the first thing that happens is you've got a huge fear factor. I mean, fear about the treatment, that's what's to come with the treatment, the surgery, the chemo, the radiation. What's all that going to be like for me? You've got fear about your outcome. Am I going to live? Really an existential question right there. What's going to happen to me? So you have that initial strong fear. But then to kind of mediate that a little bit, you get incredible support welling up from both people in your world, your family, your friends, but people in the cancer community. Once you've become a member of the cancer community, you don't really ever leave it, and you are there for others who follow you. We're all in a club that no one wants to be a member of. And yeah, there are way too many of us in this unwanted club. So you get just an upwelling of support, which carries you along in a hugely powerful way. The other thing, and all of this, it happens differently for everybody, but you find kind of what is the place for you that's right on a continuum of, I'm passively focusing on my conventional cancer treatment that my oncology team that I have trust in, this is what they're telling me to do. End of story. I don't want to think about anymore or do anymore. That's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is being, I'd call it more proactive, understanding that conventional cancer treatment, the big three, surgery, chemo, radiation, it's the nucleus for all your other treatments, to be sure, but it's just one tool in your toolbox. And you have the power as the person with cancer to say, I want to do other things to help optimize my outcome. And I want to take responsibility for exploring those things, figuring out what's right for me, and going with those, adding them to my other tools. And that sense of proactivity, wherever you find yourself on that spectrum, can actually lead you to some, I think, broader implications about, you know, your cancer experience beyond your treatment. You start to think about, how do I prevent people in my life from getting cancer? How do I reduce my own risk of getting another cancer? And can I address those questions by getting involved as a volunteer, as an activist? So kind of going beyond your own immediate medical situation to, where does that situation, that health crisis, take you next? And those things are open to us all.
Yeah, how do you protect other people from entering the club?
That's right. And just to add one quick thing, Kate, there's actually some data to suggest that cancer patients who do choose to be proactive actually have better outcomes with their cancer treatment.
That's terrific. Yeah, not a passive act. So one can wonder what caused her cancer, but she'll likely never know definitively, though we have so many toxic thumbprints all over us. If globally 1 in 8 women will experience breast cancer in her lifetime, what would you like to say to these women about the relationship between toxics and cancer that you know about?
Well, there's a lot. And just to tick off a couple of the main pollutants that we're all exposed to in our world, that is difficult to escape unless you're very consciously taking steps to avoid them. Air pollution would be one. Pesticides would be another. PFAS that we're learning a lot about, the forever chemical that's in all our nonstick pans and our rain-resistant outerwear, and a whole class of chemicals called endocrine-disrupting compounds. And they're sort of everywhere. And each one of these sources of pollution have cancer outcomes, different kinds of cancers, of course. So, for example, air pollution is going to produce respiratory cancers. PFAS, the forever chemical, is going to produce more kidney and testicular cancers. Pesticides will produce childhood cancers and some lymphomas. And then endocrine disrupting chemicals are going to affect cancers that have a hormonal component to them. So breast cancer, ovarian cancer, guys, prostate cancer too, you're not off the hook. The notable thing is that each one of these big classes of pollutants have other health impacts besides cancer. And remarkably, they all have impacts on children's developing brains. If a child is exposed either in utero as a fetus or in the first 2 years of life, so about the 3 years of life, and they get exposed to some of these chemicals, it's going to affect the way their brain is developing, meaning it's going to affect the whole course of their lives.
And we're seeing hugely increased numbers of children with learning disabilities and autism
that's right.
ADHD and that's all the fun
exactly
stuff.
Right. And at the other end of life, as we age, more and more cognitive declines, even dementia and Alzheimer's. Now we're understanding that those same chemicals that are causing damage in the developing child's neurosystem are causing damage in the elderly nervous system.
If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants, Less Toxics and More Health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Ruth Hennig. She's been highlighting the connection between toxic exposures and ill health. Yet, through her own experiences, it sounds like, Ruth, you found a way to take action around protecting your health and the health of others. I wonder what you might say are some things that people can do, perhaps if they've had cancer and they're through the perils of it. How do you get invested? How do you protect yourself and how do you protect others?
Such a great question. There's big and lots of answers to that. The first thing I think about is that my cancer, anyone's cancer, I think of it as sort of a three-legged stool in terms of its causation. There's things that I did, choices I've made in my life that increased my risk of cancer. The diet that I had as a younger person. I was a heavy drinker and I did the usual smoking in college, which everybody in my generation did. I worked in a laboratory, a medical lab, and was exposed to a bunch of toxic solvents. I didn't have children at a young age, and statistically, your risk of breast cancer increases if you have children after the age of 26. Well, look at in our culture, most women are having children now in not until their 30s.
Yeah, your 30s or your 20s, which they are not.
Yeah. Then there's the environment, which I can't do as much about. As a kid, I'm of the age where there were these pesticide spray trucks that would just travel up and down streets in suburban Minneapolis spraying for mosquitoes. And the kids would just run after those.
Just like the good humor truck.
Fun, yeah. And then there's your genes in the environment and how do they interact? And so it's, again, a three-legged stool, but there are things on that stool that you can actually do things about in order to reduce your risk of either cancer or other health impacts. You want to start by reducing your and your family's exposures to toxics in the home and get rid of all the toxic cleaning products and bathroom products, thinking anything under the sink, kitchen or bathroom. Take a look at the ingredients in those bottles. There's natural alternatives to almost all of them now. Eliminate plastics in your whole range of activities between growing food, buying food and cooking food and storing food. Just get rid of all the plastics, replace them with glass. Now, those things take time. I actually have done those, but I didn't rush into it. I did that over multiple years.
I love that you say that.
Yeah.
Because it's quite overwhelming to transform your whole life while you're busy living your
life. Yeah, it is, especially if you have kids. You are packing lunch things for them in cute little plastic containers. But there are alternatives to everything. But you don't really have to feel like, okay, on one weekend, I'm getting rid of all the plastic and all the cleaning products.
It's a long haul process.
Yeah. Similarly, reduce your use of chemicals like lawn care chemicals or in school playgrounds.
Yeah, ask your town to stop spraying the town greens where you all sit and watch the concert.
Exactly. So you've looked at your own household and your garage with all the half-filled paint cans and solvents and stuff. But then what about your community? What about the schools, the parks, the libraries, your workplace? I mean, so there's that community engagement component that is absolutely critical once you've thought about your own house. And then last rung out, I would say, is, okay, you've got energy, you've got ideas, you've done some of these things already, you've got a lot of deep concerns about your health and your family's health, and what are you finding in the environment? That's when you think about volunteering as an activist for an organization, whether it be local, national, international, sort of whatever resonates with you, wherever you find meaning and impact, go there.
There's so many to choose from. Yeah. And you chose two in particular. Would you like to say what those are?
Well, just in terms of where you can get really good information about everything we've been talking about, there's a couple of good places to go. Healthy Babies Bright Futures, which is hbbf.org, Environmental Health Working Group, ewg.org. You mentioned Defend Our Health. That's another great organization. Toxic Free Future in Washington State does amazing work. So there's sources of information as well as places to go when you are ready, or if you're ready, to take that step to being a volunteer or an activist.
Thank you. And thanks for those resources. I will link to them on the website, whatmamawants.org.
Great.
So what do you think? What does Mama want to do about toxics and breast cancer?
Well, it's, I think, kind of simple. So if I think of Mama with a little m, that's my mama, you know, and what she wants is all of us to have safer places to live, work, play, learn. We want to detoxify our home and our world. We want our kids and our families to be healthy. I mean, bottom line, if I think about the big mama of us all, the Mother Earth, she's just screaming to us, stop polluting me. Stop poisoning the humans on this planet, the wildlife on this planet, the beautiful ecosystems of forests and lakes. You know, we were pristine once. We can come back to that, but we need all of you, all of us, to stop polluting. And that's what Mama wants.
Way to channel Gaia. That's awesome, Ruth. So to close this interview, I'd like to ask you a few quick fire questions about your personal relationship with the earth, if you're game. Okay. As a kid, what was your favorite thing to do outside in nature?
Well, so where I was living, it wasn't just everything is built and paved over. I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and so there was a lot of open space still. And just behind my house was this kind of wild field with foxes and monarch butterflies. And for those of us who are old enough to realize that there used to be so many monarch butterflies just flying around. Now you see one and it's, wow, you know, a survivor. And so those early experiences with wildlife out in admittedly a little patch of nature in a suburb of a major city, it's hardly pristine wilderness. As a 5 or 6 year old, that had an indelible effect on me.
That's sweet. Describe a scene in nature when you have felt awe.
I love the ocean, and I love Maine's coastline, to be sure. Another awesome place where I personally have experienced a lot of awe is on the Oregon coast, with its beautiful wide beaches where you can walk for miles, and these stunning green cliffs that just crash right down to the water in this very dramatic way. And so I can go to the Oregon coast anytime and be absolutely in awe.
Sweet. What's your favorite baby animal, Ruth?
Oh, gosh. I was at the National Zoo in D.C. a couple months ago, and I gotta say, those baby pandas were super cute.
I know. They invented the stuffed animals
right,
for them.
That's right.
Ruth, you're amazing at synthesizing your personal experiences with cancer in light of all you have known about it professionally. And thank you for being so open-minded and open-hearted and sharing how you have made sense of this daunting experience in your life with us. Thanks for being my guest today on What Mama Wants.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for the opportunity to have this good conversation. And thank you for your interest in this work through What Mama Wants. It's a great community resource.
Thanks, and thank you all for listening.